guess that you are hoping to train me, or at least determine if I'm dangerous to you.
Davud checked the door and the windows again. When he spoke this time, it was in a low voice.
But I have to wonder why you would risk Sukru's wrath on a gamble such as this.
I no longer fear Sukru. You, however, have plenty of reason to fear the Reaping King. He preys on young Magi, and I fear he will one day prey on you.
That's ridiculous.
Though the words came out less confidently than Davud had intended.
Sukru has been helping me since I arrived. He's helping me to learn the Red Ways. Now, yes. But Sukru, as you surely know by now, yearns for the sort of power you already wield. He has some small amount of it himself, but not nearly enough to satisfy his desires. As you grow in your abilities, so will his jealousy grow. And no doubt he's taken your blood already. Likely Anila's as well.
Davud tried to swallow the lump in his throat as the sinking feeling inside him accelerated. The sparrow laughed.
Your silence is answer enough. He's one to be careful of, Davud. He has the patience of a butterfly and the anger of a bull.
How do you know all this?
Because I was once in your position.
The spinning device continued to hum.
Know that there is a place for you here, should you wish it, out from under the watchful gaze of the House of Kings.
How do I know I can trust you?
How do you know?
The voice was incredulous, affronted, though also affected, the sort of voice actors use.
At great risk to myself, I gave you a sigil that in all likelihood saved your life in the blooming fields. Is it not so?
Davud couldn't deny it, but this was all so strange. And he wasn't at all sure that the sparrow's story was the real one. And there was Anila to consider. If he left, it would mean something terrible for Anila.
I thank you for your offer, truly, but I think it's best if I remain here.
The spinning triangle went silent. It hummed in the air for so long that Davud reached up to touch it. When he did, the finch hopped forward and pecked his hand.
Very well,
the voice said as Davud sucked on his knuckle.
But let us speak again, yes? Keep the device secret. It works under starlight. Simply give it a spin and I shall be there.
As the words faded, the triangle lowered toward the table. Davud caught it in his hands as the firefinch flew into the night. The triad's edges and angles were warm as melted candle wax. Part of him wanted to throw it over the nearby wall so he'd never find it again. But another part wanted to keep it safe, a talisman against a coming storm. The two warred for a time, but then Davud stuffed it away inside his thorb and returned to the palace, feeling watched and vulnerable. His earlier thoughts of having his family visit him vanished like summer rain. The following day, Davud entered his room to find the patio doors open. Anila was sitting at a table, hunched over as she often was while eating. Except she wasn't eating. She was bent over a book, and not just any book, but an ancient text on blood magic, a source that had broadened Davud's understanding of its use, the sigils that guided the magic, and even a bit of history of those who had used it in the service of the kings of Sharakai. Since returning from Ishmantep, he'd never seen Anila read. She'd done no more than eat, sleep, and suffer through what had surely become a miserable grind of an existence. But now, Davud glimpsed a bit of the old Anila, the woman who was curious and always ready with answers for the Kalidia masters, or pointed questions that showed a strong mastery of the subject at hand. Davud had thought her thirst for knowledge burned out of her for good. But here she was, reading as intently as ever, though the subject of study sent a chill down Davud's spine. He tried to close the door silently but wasn't careful enough. It clicked and Anila's head lifted. He thought she had heard him but realized a moment later he had been wrong. She was staring at the fig tree on the patio, and he was certain he knew why. He stepped closer, ducked down and peered through the nearby window. There was the firefinch, and Davood was suddenly and inexplicably concerned that Anila had overheard his conversation with the triangle. The finch was perfectly still. As Anila stood and stepped toward it, it flapped its wings and flew down to a lower branch. It flitted higher, then lower again, then higher once more. It looked frantic, a bird caught in a cage as the cat approaches. Anila looked fascinated, as if it were the first time she had seen a bird in her life. The closer she came to the tree, the more the finch's movements slowed. As she reached out to grab it, Davood walked quickly onto the patio. Anila turned, eyes wide, shivering like a gutter wren caught stealing bread. The bird fluttered up and away, and was soon lost beyond one of the palace's minarets.
"What were you doing?" Davood asked.
Lowering her arm, Anila visibly calmed herself, shuffled past him and sat at the table, ignoring Davood as she resumed her study. He stood opposite her, but she kept her gaze down. The sunlight reflected off her reptilian skin.
"Anila, what were you doing with that bird?"
She folded her hands, studiously not looking at Davood, and then she shocked him. She spoke.
"The next time you wish to know something, Davood, ask me, not Bella."
Her words were slurred, drunken from the pain and the damage she had endured. For a moment, Davood could think of nothing to say. These were the first words she had said to him since Ishmantep.
"Very well," he managed, wanting to say so much more.
She glanced down at the book, as if it were her chosen reading for a pleasant Saturday afternoon. She touched one corner and shifted it ever so slightly.
"Have you learned anything from the sigils?"
"What?
No, I mean, yes, I have, but nothing to help with."
He motioned ineffectually to her form. Gods, how he wished he could sweep her pain away and bring the old Anila back.
"I don't mean..."
She closed her eyes, swallowed once, then tried again.
"I only wish to know what Sukru is teaching you."
Confused, Davood shook his head.
"Why?" "Sukru wouldn't suffer your existence, or mine, if he didn't think he would get something out of it."
She used that tone of hers, the one that condescended, still stubbornly refusing to look at him.
"So you must ask yourself, what does he want?" "I don't care about Sukru, and I don't care about the book. I only care that you..."
He stopped, for she had raised one hand and closed her eyes as if she couldn't bear to hear it.
"I'm sorry, Anila." "Stop it."
Davood pulled the chair out and sat down.
"We must speak of what happened."
He reached his hand out to take hers, but she pulled away, clearly pained by the sudden movement.
"No! Why? Because it doesn't matter."
"Of course it matters.
It's history, Davood."
Her words echoed off the cold walls of the patio. She spoke slowly at first, but the more she went on, the more her confidence and pace increased.
"We were taken by Hamsakir. Nearly turned into those mindless things. Those shambles. But by the grace of the gods, you saved us both. You tried to deliver us back to Sharakai. You nearly did, until I forced you to go to Ishmantep. Forced you beyond your skills. Forced you to use your power before you were ready.
Her eyes were red and watery as she looked at him at last. There was a well of pain there, a small glimpse into what she had lived through.
This happened because of my presumption. This is the punishment the gods have given me for my lack of charity, for ushering you into danger.
Dear Anila.
He found tears coming to his own eyes. He would have taken her hand, were it not sure to cause her pain.
You're wrong. I am a man grown. I could have denied you any time I wished. I wanted those things as much as you did.
She stared at him, lost in her sorrow. She blinked away her tears, diamonds over fields of coal.
Dear Davud.
She smiled, then laughed, a bitter echo of their days at the Collegia.
Do you not remember those days? You could no more have said no to me than a hyena could sing.
Davud wanted to laugh, but he didn't have it in him.
You were no force of nature, Anila.
Perhaps not. But you were no man. Not then. Not yet.
Teeth gritted, she lifted her bandaged arm and ran the back of her fingers along his cheek.
But you've changed.
We've both changed,
she nodded.
We may both be forces of nature yet.
Davud didn't like the way she'd said that, as if she'd stop at nothing for revenge.
So,
she said, motioning to the book again.
What have you found?
Anila, I don't think sharing this is a good idea.
The small glimmer of hope in her face vanished.
Why not?
The king shared this with me so that I could help him. But if he knew you were reading it...
He gave it to you knowing full well we're sharing this room.
He stepped over, picked up the book and held it to his chest.
Concentrate on getting better, Anila. On the day you can return to your family.
I don't want to. I want to bring Hamzakir to justice.
As he stepped away, she stood. From the look of pain and concentration on her face, it was clear how much that small movement cost her.
Sukru has summoned me. I'll send for Kaelira to tend to your wounds today.
I want to help,
she said. It was a command from a woman of Golden Hill, accustomed to being obeyed.
I can't allow it,
he said, walking through the patio doors back into the room.
I won't.
You won't allow it,
she cried as he reached their chamber door.
You owe me this, Davud. You owe it to me.
I owe you much,
Davud thought as he opened the door and left.
But not this.
Chapter 20 Chayda sat with Ishak and Leora inside a pavilion. The floor was layered with a host of riotously coloured carpets. The smell of cook fires filled the space as the entrance's flaps blew lazily in the warm desert wind. Ishak sat opposite her. Leora's bent form was cradled in a nest of pillows to Chayda's left. On the low wooden table between them was one glass of arak each and a shisha with four tubes snaking out from it. Only Leora was drawing from her tube, producing swirls of smoke that twisted their way up toward the vent. With it came the scents of sunburnt stone, aging leather and fragrant rosewood. Ishak raised his drink high, Leora did the same, followed by Chayda, and the three of them downed a healthy swallow of the sweet, biting arak. He then motioned to the empty place on his left.
Would that your mother could have joined us,
he said to Chayda.
Four generations sitting side by side is a rare thing indeed.
Chayda didn't know what to say. It would have been sweet, but had Aya still been alive, the four of them would almost certainly not be here in the desert drinking arak in a pavilion. Still, she raised her glass to the empty place and took another swallow.
"Let us speak plainly," Ishak said. "Our tribe is in dire straits. Onur has fled the desert to raise an army of his own. Hamzakir is peeling away support among the 12 tribes. Malasan prepares to march west and cross the mountains to the desert. Kaimir and Mireya have both been biding their time, but their queens will not sit idly by, especially if Malasan allows a single one of their soldiers to set foot in the desert. The kings have been wounded, but are prepared to bring war to the desert unless we are given up to them. If we don't take care, it will be a culling, like we've not seen since Bet Iman."
Like a northern mountain dragon, Leora breathed smoke into the air between them.
"You would speak of war and murder before we've had the chance to hear Chayda's tale." "It is part and parcel of Chayda's tale, and hers is but one piece of the grand tapestry we all weave."
Ishak regarded Chayda with a seriousness that reminded her of Kiral, the King of Kings.
"I've been told much about you and Sharakai, but I would hear it from you. I would know how you became a maiden and how you slew King Kulishan."
Chayda was deathly tired of being questioned by men like her grandfather and being given so little in return. So it had been with Osman, then with the kings, especially King Yusam, and again with Onur here in the desert only days before. She'd be damned before she let it happen again.
"Tell me where Emre is first."
Ishak stared at her, his brow pinching. For long moments, words failed him.
"Great things are afoot. And you would ask me of the boy you grew up with?"
Chayda took an olive from the platter set between them and chewed. A low rumbling sound filled the pavilion. Ishak, his face turning red, gave Leora an indignant stare. Leora was oblivious, however, her body heaving as a cascade of throaty, rolling laughs escaped her.
"Gojan, sweet kiss," he said. "What are you laughing at?"
The sound built even higher. It was loud and sonorous and infectious.
"Oh, my dear son."
It took a moment more for her laughs to subside, and even then her shoulders continued to shake.
"And you thought you were free of Aya's stubbornness when she left for Sharakai?"
She laughed again, louder than before. Chayda did as well. She wasn't even sure why. After a moment, Ishak's stormy look faded, then a smile cracked his features, and then he too was laughing, though it sounded more rueful than Leora's full-throated, tent-filling mirth.
"If the gods are kind..."
Ishak began with a regal bow of his head toward Chayda.
"Emre is on his way here along with the few who remained in Sharakai."
Now this was surprising news.
"You're abandoning the city?"
She thought Ishak might deny it, but he shrugged, as if admitting it was something he would never have considered years before.
"The host is patient. The kings have thrown their lot in with Hamzakir. Better to leave and see what the kings will do with a man who wishes to rule Sharakai alone."
"And if they let Hamzakir take up his father's crown?"
"It would be like inviting an adder into their midst. Sooner or later he'll try to sink his fangs into them. And if Hamzakir does take up his father Kulishan's crown, he will have forfeited his support in the desert to us. None of those aiding him now would openly support a king of Sharakai."
"You're assuming he hasn't ensorcelled them in some way?"
"He may have," Ishak said. "But it cannot last. Such power fades over time, and would leave the tribes even more eager for revenge. Either way, their power will be returned to us. And if he continues his fight against the kings, they will have no choice but to focus on him, which will allow us to heal in the desert.
Will Masid and the others arrive soon?
Ishak nodded.
Been a few days. No more than a week.
Please deliver Emre safely,
Jada prayed.
And what then?
Ishak knocked back the last of his drink, then poured for all three of them.
That depends greatly on what we learn from them.
He paused before setting the green bottle down with a thump.
And you.
Jada tipped her head in acknowledgement that it was time to tell her tale. She covered it in broad strokes at first, from the kiss Sahid Alaz had given her in the canal when she had gone to save Emre, to the poems hidden in her mother's book, and her visit with Celia in the desert, to the fight with the Blade Maiden in the fields after the Adikara had pierced her thumb. She told them of Daudzada delivering her to the House of Maidens, how Zaid had saved her, how she had felt the Asurim in the blooming fields on the night she had killed Kulashan, the Wandering King. Ishak and Leora both interrupted at times, looking for clarifications or deepening of their knowledge. So it was some time before she finished, up to and including the harrowing events on the Night of Endless Swords, her flight into the desert, and her time in Onur's camp. Ishak seemed to peer through the far wall of the pavilion.
You can truly feel the Asir.
Kerim was far out in the desert, cowering, listening to this conversation as if he were a part of it, as if he could speak and his voice might be heard.
I am your voice, she told him.
He was too embarrassed to reply. He felt as if he had been caught with his hand in her purse, but she could feel the gratitude within him as well.
His name is Kerim, she said. And yes, I can.
With his drink, Ishak motioned to Chayda's left wrist, where Masut's bracelet lay.
There as well.
She ran her fingers over the polished onyx stone.
Yes, but only distantly, as if we're parted by a thick curtain.
And now you've come here,
Leora said, a smile crinkling the corners of her eyes.
Yes.
She took a deep breath, preparing to voice the thought she had been wrestling with.
But I can't stay long.
She faced Ishak squarely.
I would return to Sharakai, grandfather, and I could use help when I arrive. I need people I can trust for food, weapons, or places to hide as I make plans.
What plans?
First, there are those in the House of Maidens I would speak to.
Zaid?
Among others. I wish to see if any will join our cause.
A bark of a laugh filled the pavilion, but a moment later when he realized she was serious, he sobered.
The Maidens, Chedar. We have some few spies like Zaid, but you'll find no more allies there.
I disagree. I think I can turn one of the women from my hand.
Who?
Melis.
Melis Yuzamava. She's fiercely loyal to the kings.
She is, but she tires of the struggle. Sumeya does as well.
Ishak reeled, an angry look distorting his rough features. He turned to Leora.
Are you listening to her?
Then to Chayda.
Sumeya is first warden.
Yes, but you don't know these women like I do. At the very least I'll be able to sow doubt among them, and I would look further into the silver trove.
Ishak made a chopping motion with his hand.
Who told you about that? Your mother? It's nothing but a wild tale, Chayda.
Perhaps, and perhaps not. I would learn the truth either way. And lastly, the Asurim are there. I must know if there's a way to free them. Zaid may help. Melis or Sumeya may too. Perhaps even our lost king, Sahid Alaz.
The hint of a frown that seemed always to be present on his lips deepened.
Even bone crushers learn to eat their kills one bite at a time, girl.
I'm no girl.
He paused, his dark eyes assessing her anew.
No, you're not. You've done much to sing about, which makes your words all the more bitter. With you safe at last, I thought you would join us.
I may still, but all roads lead to Sharakai. The Asirim are there. The maidens are there. The kings are there.
The desert is in turmoil. Tribe Masal has fallen to Anur. Word came only yesterday that tribe Kadri have sent emissaries to him. Their sheikh, Mihir Halim Ava al-Kadri, the new lord of the Burning Hands, has little love for the kings of Sharakai, and sees this as an opportunity for revenge for his mother's death at the hands of King Ishan. Onor may soon have the strength of three tribes at his command, and when word spreads, a fourth may follow, then a fifth. If we're not careful, he may unite all the desert tribes.
Doubtful, Jada said. Tribes Ebros, Okan, and Kenan are loyal to the kings. The rest have no reason to take up sword and spear to stand against Sharakai, certainly not standing beneath Onor's banner.
You are a child of Sharakai,
he replied in lofty tones,
so you cannot understand how ready the tribes are to see the kings fall. Few will say it openly, and many will not be easily convinced it can be done, but there is a long, burning hatred in every tribe. Onur, though a king himself, need only to throw oil on that flame for it to be rekindled.
He paused.
Perhaps, but after due thought, we'll be the oil that spreads the fire. This is why we've taken such a risk in calling the tribe together. We're ready to decide how our tribe, Tribe Kianat, will proceed, which is why I'm glad you've come. You have much to offer. You can share what you know of the kings. You can train those who need it.
When Chayda said nothing, Ishak stated it flatly.
Join us, Chayda, for those of our tribe. The roads of Sharakai have too often led to the farther fields. We need everyone we can, here, in the desert.
She couldn't do it. Not now, in any case. Accept, and she would formally become a part of the tribe. Accept, and she would need to obey his commands, just like everyone else in the tribe did.
I will return to Sharakai.
Even though Melis may betray you at her first opportunity, even though the silver trove may be a mirage, even though it may take you years to undo the chains that bind the Asirim.
Yes. Who am I to you anyway, but one more warrior to add to your ranks?
You are my granddaughter.
Then give your granddaughter the freedom she needs.
Ishak was red-faced. There were words on his lips. A command for Chayda to remain, no doubt. But just then, a bell began to ring. A call to the midday meal. Leora spoke quickly.
Help an old woman to food by a fire with those she loves.
And she held out her arm for Ishak to take. After a moment's hesitation, he did.
We are not done discussing this,
he said to Chayda.
Not by a league.
Then he helped Leora toward the exit. As Chayda rose to follow, Leora turned and winked at her. Chapter 21 The sun was setting over the Shangazi. Chayda sat on the sand near a spitting fire, while dozens of small children gabbled and groused and giggled around her. They were in the space between the tribe's ships, and it was a bustle with the ends of the midday meal. The heat of the day was easing, and the air was filled with stories, mirth, and no small number of friendly arguments. The day had flown by. After a meal with the tribe, Chaida and Leora had taken a long walk together. Her constitutional, Leora called it, then sat on the deck of her yacht and talked. Leora seemed to be taking great pains to keep the conversation light. She spoke of inconsequential things, the food Chaida liked, the ones she hated, particularly those Aya might have forced her to eat. She laughed when Chaida confessed to despising eggplant, a thing her mother insisted on making at least once a week.
"That was my recipe," Leora said, then laughed at Chaida's embarrassment.
"I liked it a bit," Chaida said, trying to recover.
But Leora waved her worries away.
"There's no telling the appetites of babes. I never liked it much myself. We rarely had it. Few enough caravans carried eggplant in those days. But when we did, I always took a stack of flatbread and devoured half the bowl herself. I suspect it became a piece of home after she had left the desert."
They spoke further of the sights, sounds, and smells of the city. They spoke of music, of plays, of junglers and storytellers, and the confidence men of Sharakai, who preyed on those who came to the city with purses full of gold and eyes full of wonder. Occasionally Chaida would ask Leora of life here in the desert. She would gladly answer, but always in such a way that allowed her to steer the conversation back to the desert's amber jewel.
"She's fascinated by it," Chaida realized. "Perhaps because Aya went there and she never saw her daughter again. Or because she'd never been. Or both."
From then on, Chaida went on at length on any topic Leora chose. There would be time soon enough to talk about growing up in the great Shangazi. When the evening meal came, Chaida decided to sit with a group of the children. She missed their laughs, the sound of them playing along the streets of Rose Ridge. A young girl with brown hair hanging like a curtain over her face looked over to Chaida and gestured at her bowl.
"Do you like it?"
Chaida smiled.
"It's joyous."
The girl's grin was wide as the sunset. She had helped to make the stew. As she had made a point of telling Chaida and everyone else before they'd sat to eat. The food was simple but mouth-watering. Spit-roasted goat on a broth of tomatoes and onions and pine nuts over puffy brown rice. Lemon-salted flatbread dipped into a mouth-watering yogurt, laced with garlic and goat cheese, and a fresh herb collected from the nearby mountainside that tasted like fire-kissed cumin. They drank clear, natural well water, laced with cucumber and mint, and arrak, the likes of which she had never tasted. It had a nose of rich leather and hints of smoke, tasted like currant and fireberry jam mixed with fresh honey and finished with a pleasant coppery burn.
"My own,"
said an old thin man, one fire over when he saw how much she appreciated it. He was raising his glass, and Chaida raised hers in reply.
"An elixir Baki himself must lust after."
He smiled more broadly, revealing a landscape of missing teeth. Then both of them took another healthy swallow. The twin moons rose in the eastern sky. Tulithan, a silver sickle. Rhea, a beaten golden coin. There was music and dancing and song. When the true night fell, Kerim released a long wail that fell across the celebration like a burst of rain. The music stopped. All, even Ishak, looked around nervously. They were used to this, Chaida realized, the threat from the kings always hounding them, always hanging over their heads.
"Please,"
she said, standing and raising her glass.
"All is well."
She motioned for the music to continue, then took the hand of the girl who'd sat by her side. She had been dancing with her brother, and Chaida motioned them both to dance with her. They did, the three of them twirling with one another as the song resumed. The mood of merriment returned. if slightly more subdued than before.
May I have this dance?
A voice asked as a new song began. She knew the voice well, but was still surprised to find him standing before her when she turned.
Dad Sada.
The old apothecary bowed his head to her, his hand raised.
When did you arrive?
She asked, as she accepted his hand and the two of them began to dance over the carpets.
Only a short while ago.
Jada looked over his shoulder toward the ships, where others were trudging toward the gathering, some carrying huge bunches of fresh dates over their shoulders.
Is Emre with you?
No,
Dadzada smiled sadly.
I thought he'd be here by now.
They danced for a while, the two of them silent. It felt strange. Their history still stood between them, him raising her for a time after her mother died, the harsh way he'd treated her. But she couldn't deny it felt good.
Do you plan to stay with the tribe?
Jada asked.
Find yourself a wife?
This time when Dadzada smiled, it was genuine.
I fear it's too late for me. I am married to our cause.
Jada laughed. I dare say you could be married to the cause and still share warmth beneath the blanket.
You may be right. Perhaps I'll be struck by Yerinde's curse yet.
Continuing to dance, Jada took in the night around her. The ships, the songs, the dancing, the children running around their parents or spinning until they fell laughing to the carpets on the sand.
What are we doing out here, Dadzada?
Rebuilding,
Dadzada said as the song began to pick up its pace.
It's hard to believe it, isn't it? That we're finally coming together.
It is,
he replied softly.
And it's dangerous as well.
She looked to Ishak, who was sitting with several older men and women, each drawing from a shisha tube and talking low with one another. For a moment, Jada saw them in their youth, not so different from how she, Emre, Tariq, and Hamid once were.
You don't approve?
She asked Dadzada.
Who am I to approve or disapprove of what Ishak is doing?
The danger may be great, Jada said, but it was always going to be. No matter when it happened. Perhaps it will give everyone heart. Perhaps it will bolster support for us among the other tribes. Perhaps it will sway those in Sharakai as well. It could even lead to revolt in the city.
Perhaps, but there is no doubt it will soon attract the attention of the kings. Sooner or later they will come for us.
Then we'll have to be ready for them, won't we?
In that moment, Jada wished she was already on the way to Sharakai. She closed her eyes as Dadzada lifted her hand and she twirled. The music, the conversation, the laughter. It filled her. She hadn't realized how much she needed this, a reminder of all she had been fighting for.
If we accomplish nothing else, we will have revealed the truth. The kings will have to admit what happened to our tribe.
Oh, Jader.
Dadzada stopped dancing, though he still held her hands.
Even before I left, the kings were starting rumors, spreading more propaganda, saying the Moonless Host are pretenders who are fabricating stories of a lost tribe for their own benefit. It's laughable, they're saying. The traitor Ishak's last gamble as the Host lose faith in him. The lords and ladies in the House of Kings and Golden Hill are eating it up, spreading it wide. Those who live off the teat of the kings believe it, or say that they do, prompting others to repeat the same story. Only in the West End do they speak openly of denying the king's stories, and when have they ever mattered in the grand scheme of Shalakai's workings?
The truth will spread,
Jada said. Releasing Dadzada's hands.
It must!
Dadzada shrugged as if this meant little more to him than the price of figs.
Only the gods can know. But already the war of ideas has resumed. Death comes for those who speak openly of the 13th tribe, while those who take the king's word are favored.
When will it end? Jada wondered, but she already knew the answer.
When the kings lay dead, their bodies burned, their bones buried in the sand.
She glanced east, where Kerim was hidden by the night.
No, she vowed. The truth will come. I will make them believe.
Kerim's wail lifted above the celebration. It was lonelier this time, an echo of Chader's feelings. The celebration quieted, but Ishak nodded to the musicians who hardly missed a beat.
Free us,
Kerim pleaded. Gods, the ache in him. She could feel it smoldering in her chest.
Soon, she replied. Trust me.
Jada,
a voice called from across the nearby fire. Leora was beckoning Jada to follow her, a solemn expression on her tattooed face. For a moment, the amethyst on her left hand seemed to glow in the firelight before her. Jada blinked, realizing just how much arak she had drunk, and the strange effect was gone.
I am called away, she said to Dardzada.
Dardzada waved one meaty hand.
Go! We can speak tomorrow.
Jada followed Leora, who led Jada toward her yacht. Her limp was noticeably better. She walked more upright, as if the years no longer weighed on her so heavily.
Probably the arak, Jada thought,
though she couldn't remember seeing Leora drink any. Inside the yacht, they moved to Leora's cabin, which was small but had more than enough room for both of them to sit. Leora on her bed, Chadar on a small padded stool near the desk built against the opposite wall. Colorful scarves and sun catchers were arrayed like the petals of a blooming flower across the ceiling. A lantern hanging from a hook at the center set the petals to dancing.
Pleasant, Chadar thought. Something uniquely Leora's.
I've something to show you, Leora said, as she rummaged in a small chest by her feet.
She took out a piece of papyrus, upon which was an impressive charcoal sketch of a tattoo laid across a woman's back.
My back, Jada realized.
Dardzada's oval-shaped tattoo, the ancient calligraphic sigil he had forced on her when she had turned 13, was in the center. Above it, Leora had sketched Turiat and added lyrical words that captured the battle, the death of King Misut, and the role she had played in both. More of her tail, including small pictographs, were added along her shoulder blades, so that together it all looked like a spread-winged falcon across her upper back and neck, with the tips of the feathers brushing her shoulders and arms.
It's beautiful, Jada said.
I'm glad you think so,
Leora replied. She motioned to a set of inks and bowls and various bamboo tattooing needles.
Shall we begin?
Now?
What better time? You'll be leaving for Sharakai soon.
Not if Ishak has anything to say about it.
Leora's smile was confident.
Ishak will come around.
Jada stared at the drawing, taking in all of the words, all of the images, and how they seemed to be consuming Dardzada's old tattoo.
No, not consuming it. Adding to it. Creating a larger tale.
Suddenly tears were falling down her cheeks. She wiped them away and nodded to Leora. After shifting the stool, she shrugged her arms out of her thorb and gathered the cloth around her waist. Leora poured blue inks into a well, then wiped Chader's skin with an arak-soaked rag. Then she set to, tapping away with a striking stick, the needle biting into the nape of Chader's neck.
I hope you'll remain long enough for me to finish it.
Her speech seemed to have a different cadence than earlier in the day. Chader might not have noticed had they not talked so much after the discussion with Ishak. It wasn't something she could attribute to liquor. If anything, Leora was talking more steadily than before.
You're being foolish, Chader thought.
Leora had vanished for some time as the sun was setting,
She might have simply taken a nap.
Of course I will,
Chayda said.
You remind me of Aya, you know. You're direct. You stand your ground. You're loyal to those you love, but Aya was always headstrong. Too much so in the end.
She killed a king.
One. When her goal was to kill them all.
As she continued to strike the needle, Chayda's body rose to meet the pain and it became something wider, deeper, something more grand, as if the pain itself were telling part of Chayda's tale.
Ishak isn't like Honor, you know. He isn't a king and doesn't pretend to be.
Chayda stiffened. He wants to control me.
Yes and no. He wants control over his burgeoning tribe, a thing I can hardly blame him for. He's navigated the sands well enough since taking the reins of power so many years ago, but that isn't the only reason he asked you. He doesn't want to lose you as he lost Aya. And when he looks at you, he can't help but be reminded of her.
It made perfect sense, but for some reason the realization made her uncomfortable.
Was it difficult for him when he learned of her death?
As Leora leaned back to stretch, the sound of whooping and laughter drifted in from outside.
Of course, she said, resuming her work. That isn't quite what I meant, though. Ishak lost Aya 10 years before she died at the hands of the kings. He never wanted her to go to Sharakai. He was fearful from the beginning over what might happen to her.
Leora paused her needle.
Sit still.
Chayda realized she'd started to shake.
You're skittish as a lost kitten, Chedamine.
She wasn't even sure why until she voiced her next question.
Did he know why Aya went to Sharakai?
Leora took a moment to respond.
Say what you mean.
Did he know she intended to have a child from one of the kings?
Leora laughed, a deep rumble of a laugh.
I suspect there's another question hiding behind that one, but as you wish. I'll answer them as they come. Yes, he knew, which is perhaps why he resisted for so long. But I am a persistent woman, as was your mother. Eventually, reluctantly, he came to see it as a wish cast into the wind.
A wish that could cost his daughter her life.
Indeed, a wish that was likely to cost her life.
Then why did he agree? Why did she want a child from one of the kings?
Tulathan's poems. We found one part, the end, we believe, that spoke of a scion who would play a part in the downfall of the kings. But Aya, like many of us who believe that Tulathan recited poems on Betiman, grew frustrated the more she learned. 4 centuries had already passed. How long did the people of the Lost Tribe have to wait? She believed that by going to Sharakai, by having you, she would force the hand of the fates.
Chayda turned on her stool.
I'm no messiah.
Leora returned Chayda's shoulders to the proper position.
No one said you were. You are one who may help lead us to our freedom. One of dozens, hundreds, who've worked toward this end over generations.
The way Leora spoke of both Aya and Chayda made Chayda feel like a means to an end, nothing more. And it showed, perhaps, why Ishak would sacrifice his own daughter. The talk had lit a fire in Chayda's heart, one she was careful not to blow upon lest it grow and burn her.
You know who my father is, don't you?
Now there's the question that was hiding earlier.
Chayda felt the heat rising in her cheeks. She felt like a child all over again.
A woman deserves to know who her father is.
Most do, yes, but in your case it might do more harm than good.
How could it?
You've said you have a mission to complete, to kill the kings of Sharakai. Would you complete it if you knew who your father was?
Of course I would.
Oh? Even if he had nothing to do with your mother's death?
The kings deserve to die. No man should rule the desert for so long.
That may be true. But will it matter when you're standing before him with blade in hand? How many have been lost to matters of the heart when reason has told them otherwise? They are numerous as the stars, Cheddar, and I won't let you become another.
Cheddar turned, forcing Leora to lift her needle and striking stick.
Who is my father?
Leora laughed her rumbling laugh.
Raising your voice won't help with me, girl. We have much to do, and I won't have your mind clouded by the knowledge.
Before Cheddar could speak again, Leora raised her hand and began wiping away the excess ink from her back.
There's something else that's long overdue, Cheddar, if you'll allow me to get to it.
Cheddar stilled her tongue before she said something she'd regret.
What?
She finished wiping, then applied a salve.
You said Dadsada had given you a key.
When Cheddar nodded, she went on,
May I see it?
Cheddar reached into the small purse at her belt and held it up. Leora nodded with a melancholy smile and reached her bulk past Cheddar to pull open one of the lower desk drawers. She rummaged inside and retrieved a lacquered wooden box with beautiful ivory inlay over the surface of its lid. It was hinged and had a lock built into its front face. As Leora went to sit on the bed, Cheddar's fingers and toes began to tingle and a high-pitched tone rang in her ears. Leora held the box lovingly for a moment.
Aya made this when she was about your age.
She held it out to Cheddar.
I know withholding your father's identity hurts, but perhaps this will dull the sting.
The key in her hand felt suddenly red hot.
What is it?
I don't know. Aya gave it to me the last time I saw her. I think she knew what lay ahead and worried over you. She told me to keep it safe until you found me at last. I asked her what I should do if you never came. She told me you would.
Cheddar accepted the box with trembling hands, at which point Leora grunted and pushed herself to a stand, then ran one hand down Cheddar's hair, tugging at her ear before taking her cane and sidling along the passageway. Alone in the cabin with the sounds of revelry coming from outside the yacht, Cheddar ran her fingertips over the smooth lacquer. She admired the handiwork, the rich grain of the wood, the perfect seams of the inlay.
What are you afraid of?
She asked herself, gripping the key tightly. Swallowing hard, her hands trembling, she put the key into the lock and turned it. The hinge creaked as she lifted the lid. Inside were two things. The first was a folded piece of papyrus with a wax seal on it. The seal was a curving, ancient sign that meant wedge, or more accurately, tip of the spear. It was often used in ancient texts to indicate an event that led to many more changes, a catalyst of sorts. The second thing was a silver vial with a cap that screwed off. She was nervous about the letter, so she picked up the vial first. It was etched with an intricate design along its cylindrical length, and the cap was decorated with tiny ornamental ivy leaves. She shook it and heard something rattle inside. She unscrewed the cap and tipped the vial over her hand. Out rolled a single oblong seed, no longer than the nail of her pinky. It was ebony-coloured, but on the tip was a bit of yellow crust that looked like she could scrape it away. After slipping it back in the vial and screwing the cap back on, she took up the letter.
For Cheddar. Contained herein is a treasure stolen from the House of Kings, the seed of an acacia. Years ago, shortly before I made up my mind to go to Sharokai, I went to see Celia. She had me stand before her own acacia, the one in her garden.
No doubt by now you know the importance of that tree and the shards of glass that hang from its branches. She asked that I make the tree chime for her, in whatever way I choose. I grabbed a single branch and pulled it down, which somehow made the entire tree shake. I was swept up by the light that played through the branches, that in turn was caught and twisted by the surfaces of the glass. I was granted many visions, glimpses, I believed, of the future, or perhaps of the past. It was impossible to tell, and Celia refused to answer my questions. One of the visions I saw was of a red seed pod falling to the ground. It fell from an acacia in a vale in the mountains. Which mountains, I cannot say. There were many other trees in that vale, pine and larch and spruce. And there was a small stream near which the acacia stood tall and vibrant. Footsteps came. A man's hand reached down. Faded orange tattoos covered his palm. A golden ring with a bright emerald stone graced one finger. The hand picked up the pod and turned it over, inspecting it, I suppose. And then the vision faded. It was replaced by another, a view of the same place at dusk, though clearly it was many years later. The tree was there, but it was barren. The branches withered. A black form with cloven hooves and twin tails walked over the landscape, stopping where the pod had fallen. Black claws scratched at the ground, gouging it. A head with a crown of thorns dipped to that place. Nostrils flared as it breathed in the scent. It huffed, then roared to the dying sun, and stomped one foot on the spot where the dark earth had been revealed. As this second vision faded, I wondered if the creature was an erek. I've searched long and hard since, and believe instead it was their maker, Gojin himself, though the reason he had been searching for that fallen pod is lost to me. A third vision came, of another acacia in a garden in the middle of the desert, the very tree where I stood before. But the tree was dying, and Celia's homestead was a crumbling ruin. Time passed, and I heard word of a treasure. An acacia seed hidden in the house of the kings. I knew I must find it before I struck against the kings. It took me nearly a decade, but I found it. Hidden in one of the vaults beneath King Yusan's palace. How it came to him I do not know, nor do I know the meaning of the visions or the acacia seed. But I know they are of great import. To me, to you, to our cause. I give it to you now because soon I go to the mount. It is a journey that I hope will uncover more treasures, but there is danger there. And whatever I might find, I know the struggle for freedom is a long one. It may be that you will find the seed's place in the world, or someone close to you will. I trust the goddess will guide you. Take care, Cheddar. Listen to Leora and Devora, for they both see beyond the horizon. Ayanesh. For a long while, Cheddar stared at the letter, her chin quivering. To come so far, to come so close to speaking with her mother one last time, and have her speak as if Cheddar were a servant, a soldier to be commanded. It felt so very familiar. She'd used that tone with Cheddar while growing up, and yet, before Cheddar had opened the box, she'd still hoped there would be something special from her mother inside, for her and her alone. A token of her love, a remembrance of a moment only they shared, like seeing the vivid little bluebirds, the blazing blues in the great salt flat. But of course there wasn't. This was all about Aya and her grand quest, and about Cheddar being swept into it once more. All at once, the frustration of moving from place to place in Sharakai, of never growing roots, never knowing who she was, the distance she had always felt from her